Hello and welcome to Awin Talks, the affiliate marketing podcast. My name is Rob Davidson, content analyst in Awin's global strategy team, and I'm joined by my co-host Kevin Edwards.
Hi there.
Our global strategy director. In Craig's continued self-imposed absence from the podcast, which is not
in quarantine.
Yeah, it's not coronavirus related, thankfully. Well, as far as we know, I'm pleased to say we have a new co-host joining us today in the form of Louisa Richardson, brand commercial manager in our UK new business team. I've got that right, haven't I, Louisa?
Yeah.
Welcome,
that's right.
Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Are you welcoming me to my podcast?
Yeah.
I think that this is the first time that two people from Portsmouth have ever featured on a
podcast. Oh, God, I didn't think about that. Yeah. Oh, dear. Oh,
watch
dear.
Out.
We're going to have to remedy this next week with some Southampton guests, aren't we?
No.
In this month's episode, we have another packed schedule, or is it schedule? Schedule of content with two special guests joining us. First up, I'll be speaking to Maya Knights, Head of Industry Insight at Eagle Eye Solutions, who specialise in providing technology solutions for brands who are keen to join up their digital and physical retail experiences. Now, she was also a guest author in this year's Awin report, and so we'll get a chance to discuss the focus of her featured article in the report and her thoughts on the affiliate channel right now. And then a little bit after that, Louisa, you'll be chatting to Chris Johnson from the affiliate technology partner SmarterClick.
Yeah, that's right. So I'll be talking to Chris, who's the Director of Operations at SmarterClick. And we'll be focusing around who SmarterClick are, also looking at Chris's sort of career path within the affiliate industry, and also focusing on SmarterClick's proposition around their SmarterClick Code, which is a new product of theirs.
Great. Look forward to that. Before we get into those discussions, though, I think it is worth touching on the impact that the coronavirus is having on our industry so far, as well as obviously the wider retail and e-commerce space.
I'm allowed to mention toilet rolls.
You are allowed to mention toilet rolls, Kev, if you really want to. I think actually, because it's first worth prefacing this with a kind of disclaimer that we acknowledge that this aspect of the virus isn't maybe as important as the wider health aspect, which is obviously a far larger issue. In fact, I think there's a marketing professor called Scott Galloway. I listen to his podcast a lot. Not that I want to be in the kind of game of promoting other people's podcasts away from our own, but Pivot is really good if you want to listen to current trends in business, tech and politics. And he features on that. And he was talking about this same theme, I think, of talking about the coronavirus as primarily an economic thing. And that actually, you know, there's a far larger theme or topic that's going on that's important. And he said the worst thing that might happen, he said he was satirizing the kind of Wall Street response to the coronavirus. He said the worst thing that might happen if this turns into a pandemic and wipes out the species is that it might affect the economy, which I think kind of like quite nicely sums that up in a way, doesn't it? Now, obviously, the implications on world health are far more serious. But to paraphrase the Liverpool manager, Jurgen Klopp, who was recently quizzed on this in a press conference. I don't know if you saw this. And he said, you know, my opinion on this is really not that important. I'm a guy that wears a baseball cap and doesn't really shave. So given that, all of those disclaimers and everything.
I don't have a baseball cap.
You don't shave, though. So I think that it is an interesting topic to talk about from its kind of e-commerce retail perspective. And I know, Louisa, you've seen some of the insights that have been produced by Awin's internal teams looking at some of the data that we've tracked.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's been really interesting actually looking at the sort of year-on-year performance, especially within travel insurance. I think Rob and I were discussing earlier that not that many people probably think about taking travel insurance out for shorter trips. But we've seen a huge surge in actually people taking this travel insurance. So we're up 9% year-on-year. And what's also really interesting on that is we're seeing this huge spike in travel insurance year-on-year. But also now actually reading in the news that insurance brands are now starting to pull back on their policies, and actually some of those policies may become void due to obviously they're realizing they're going to have to be paying out a lot more on these policies. So that's a really interesting angle that we've seen this spike, but then it'll be great to see if we end up seeing a slump off the back of that as well. Wedding and travel insurance is also following suit. So wedding insurance, a lot of people traveling abroad for their weddings, and we're seeing them also now starting to pull back as well. So really interesting angle. And then completely moving away from insurance, and I guess looking at the panic buy that coronavirus is creating, a lot of the groceries we're seeing a huge uplift year on year with as well. So everyone, I know we said we wouldn't mention it, but everyone going out there buying their toilet rolls. But increasing, interestingly, we've also seen a big increase in hand sanitizer as well as a product through the network as well. So yeah, really key, interesting stats from that, which is great.
Yeah, it's really interesting, I think, to see kind of how consumer trends react to how things are being reported in the media, how information is being disseminated online. And that's a big factor in what the World Health Organization are currently trying to battle, as much as it's about the disease and trying to control that and try to find a remedy for that. It's as much about trying to control the misinformation that is necessarily being spread through online platforms that aren't necessarily policed in a way that allows that for that control. There was a publication they put out back in February which talked about exactly this idea. They labeled it an infodemic. And they said that there's been an overabundance of information, some of it accurate, but some of it not, and that that makes it harder for people to find trustworthy sources and reliable guidance when they actually need it, which I think is a really important element and something that does feed into our industry a lot.
Yeah, trust and transparency are absolutely sort of critical to the success of the affiliate channel, I think. I mean, I know you're working on a piece which should be published on the website by the time this podcast goes out, and in it you mention Martin Lewis, for example, who runs Money Saving Expert, one of the most trusted, I think it was the most trusted in a recent survey, consumer sites that's out there. And one thing, if you're tying it back to affiliate marketing, that he does is he's very clear and transparent on his site when there is a commercial relationship that exists. So when they're being paid a commission, when they're working with an affiliate network, when they're working with a sub-network like Skimlinks, for example. And that's certainly something that we're really conscious of, because we know that brands are increasingly demanding that we offer transparency about which publishers, be they influencers, bloggers, mass media sites, when they are disclosing their commercial relationships with brands. And so that is something that we're working on. We've initiated a project internally and working very closely with mass media publishers, you know, the newspapers, the magazines, to hopefully see whether there are, beyond kind of awareness and education, whether there are any kind of technical solutions that are out there. And I think this is going to become a critically important piece, not just in certain markets, but globally. We know that the FTC in the US are really hot on this. We know the ASA in the UK are very hot on this. And we're currently kind of researching what exists in other countries. And we think that there's a real appetite for industry to come up with these types of solutions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you think about all of those characteristics that the World Health Organization talked about, transparency, authority, this idea of trustworthy online sources, they all do kind of fit into that same dilemma that has really picked up speed and pace throughout markets across online advertising industries around the world in terms of advertising disclosure. And that's something that is a project that we're hoping to kind of like work on more specifically over the next kind of 12 months.
Yeah, we met very recently a host of what we label mass media publishers. I guess looking at it from a traditional point of view, you would call them traditional publishers. So you know, the newspapers, magazines, mm-hmm. who have obviously gone through a huge amount of transformation and change over the past few years as their traditional revenue streams have dried up, and they're looking at new revenue streams. And with that comes, you know, the more mainstream that our channel becomes in terms of them embracing the affiliate channel, the more it's beholden on us to kind of create sets of standards around that. And we're really interested in helping to kind of guide those big businesses because, well, for obvious reasons. And this is becoming a global, you could call it a problem, you can call it a challenge. It's an issue that needs to be addressed and will have to be addressed. It's being scrutinized by a number of different regulators in different countries. We know about it existing across Europe. We certainly know from a UK perspective the need to disclose commercial relationships. So, you know, certainly with those mass media publishers, what you're obviously seeing is sort of some degree of merging of editorial or advertorial and commercial interests. And so that need to kind of be very clear and transparent with their consumers or the readers around the commercial relationships that sit behind that. So I think that it's something that the industry hasn't done a huge amount on and probably should have done. Mm. And it's certainly something that we're really interested in exploring, and we're currently working on a few things and, you know, hopefully collaborating with those companies in particular to ensure that they have sort of solutions that help them to achieve compliance.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something that I think listeners should be aware of that we'll be working on in the coming months, and it'll be an interesting collaboration, I think. So I'm now joined on the podcast down the line by Maya Knights, Head of Industry Insights at Eagle Eye Solutions, and I'm pleased to say one of our guest contributors to this year's AWIN report, who also spoke at our UK launch event for the report recently. Hi, Maya.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Just to give the audience and the listeners at home a bit of context around Eagle Eye itself, could you give us a bit of an introduction to what you guys do?
Yeah, absolutely. So Eagle Eye is a digital marketing technology company. Our software as a service based platform is used by major grocers, retailers, and leisure and hospitality operators to essentially become the rails that their promotions and their loyalty schemes run on. I often say, you know, if you describe the payment rails that store payments run on and online payments run on in terms of credit cards offered by EMV, Eagle Eye are the rails that the non-monetary transactions that retailers might have with consumers that run on as well. So we run the Greggs app, for example, which mm-hmm. is a great example of sort of stamp card continuity, stored value to pay at checkout, plus collecting your coupons and being able to download promotions and use them in store and online for other retailers as well. So we work with a lot of big grocers too.
So I wanted to dive right into talking about your article itself that features in the report that you provided for us. And it's really focused on how retailers are beginning to bridge that gap between their online marketing and offline store experiences, which I guess is where Eagle Eye, the value really sits from you know, what you guys actually provide in terms of solution. Now, that's a dilemma that a lot of businesses have faced for several years. And I wonder why you think it's arguably taken such a long time for them to resolve, and what has arguably changed over the years to overcome those particular hurdles.
Yeah, absolutely. You make some good points and, you know, go straight to the point with your question there. I should say Eagle Eye doesn't mind whether the point of redemption for any promotion or loyalty point or reward or whatever it might be is offline and online. But what we have observed is that the industry is at a tipping point. The most succinct way to be able to sort of express it is that online needs offline almost as much as offline has seemingly needed online to ensure future growth. But breaking that down, what does that mean? It means you've seen traditional retailers battle to compete with pure play online startups by setting up their own online channels, and those have basically propped up and represented the lion's share of growth for traditional retailers, and also obviously total growth for online ones. But you're seeing online retailers now needing to and wanting to move offline, and those retailers that have well-established online and offline presences are trying to make those two a bit more complementary and trying to sort of maximize the value of having that relationship with a customer, both digitally and also physically in store. So one channel kind of needs the other as much as the other needs. It's a symbiotic relationship, a perfect storm at the moment. Mm-hmm. I think the reason it's been slow to emerge is because it's kind of tracked against the growth of online sales. And, you know, in the UK, they're about 22-24% of total retail sales at the moment. So it's starting to reach a critical mass. where joining up those two channels is actually becoming commercially and strategically important. It's becoming a requirement in order to compete with the likes of Amazon and ASOS.
For you guys, like the affiliate channel is, I'd assume, like a relatively new realm to be involved in. And I wonder what you make of the channel in terms of it being able to support this increasing convergence of digital and physical retail, what role it can play in that regard.
Yeah, well, we've certainly seen a huge uptick in interest in our technology from the entire affiliate ecosystem. We're busily working in partnership with the likes of yourself and other mm-hmm. networks. And I think that tracks again against this increased interest in bridging that online to offline gap and facilitating a converged view of online and digitally savvy customers that shop both online and offline, because evidence, research suggests and anecdotal evidence confirms that customers that shop with you across both online and offline channels are worth more than customers that shop in just one of those channels with you. Mm. So having a joined up 360 degree view of those customers is absolutely key. I think the affiliate industry has certainly grown alongside the double-digit growth of online retailers to bridge that gap between publishers and advertisers, and really facilitate the online shopping journey of consumers when it comes to search, browse, discovery, and discovery parts of the journey. The issue has arisen now, I think, or it's always been there, but it's become too big to ignore, that the search, browse and discovery parts of the journey happen both online and offline and sometimes simultaneously. Mm-hmm. But even more so, that the final stage in that journey, the purchase, the transaction, still takes place in the main in stores. Mm-hmm. Industry consensus says that around 80 to 90% of sales still complete in store. And so the affiliate networking industry has a really well-trodden, well-proven set of tools, well-trodden path in terms of facilitating that customer journey online. But now I believe the industry is calling on those networks to be able to help to bridge that gap again offline, and see not only the search, browse and discover parts of the phases of the journey, but also tie that back to the sale wherever it might complete, and that might be online or in store, considering mm-hmm. the rise in click and collect, for example. Yeah. So I think, you know, the industry's need has grown in line with retailers' need to really converge the digital and the physical shopping journeys.
Yeah, I mean, things like click and collect, for instance, I mean, that's all part of, I think, a wider transformation that we're seeing on the high street, and how, as you say, those two experiences of the online kind of searching and researching of products and then potentially going in to pick up a physical product from a physical store on the high street is really fascinating. The high street itself is undergoing huge transformations, and it's got a lot of challenges. I wonder whether you think that's that perception of the high street or shopping centres and shopping malls arguably struggling hugely in terms of like footfall is a bit of an unfair representation as far as the media is concerned, or whether you think the impact of tying these two experiences together, what that can have for the prospects of brick and mortar retail in the future?
Good questions. I think that it's twofold. The answer mm-hmm. it's why have we got here, and what can digital do to help in store, really. Mm-hmm. We've got here because I think retailers have rightfully, maybe arguably so, hedged their bets. They've set up siloed online e-commerce transactional presences, not quite knowing, you know, what the effect on their physical stores is going to be, whether that's going to cannibalize sales, and where e-commerce sales are actually going to top out in that sense as a portion of their total retail sales. But we as consumers are the ones that drive the demand. It's the job of the retailer to follow the consumer, and they follow the consumer online. And the consumer has basically said, we see no difference, no distinction between your presence online and your presence offline. So, you know, that's where we've ended up with click and collect services, for example, which really make it difficult and really test current retailer capabilities in terms of being able to join the dots up between us buying that product and then coming into the store and being able to respond to that in ever more relevant ways, in terms of by location, by the time of day that you go in, or whatever store you might nominate to collect your goods at. You know, there are certain things that they can perhaps use that information to make our journey in store even easier. So we've got here because retailers have hedged their bets, and unfortunately, as a result, in following the customer, and the customer has embraced online, embraced a merged, converged digital physical shopping experience, their stores have been slightly left exposed, characterized as underperforming and overstored, really. Mm. So they've got some commercial structural pain to go through to really understand where e-commerce is going to top out, to really understand the mix that e-commerce is going to play with stores, the role that stores have to play as a result, and do the rationalization to make sure that the stores that are left are more effective in terms of complementing and competing with the digital online presence that they and their competitors have. Mm. I'm a huge, firm believer in the fact that because we're already embracing digital, and increasingly so via mobile, that mobile in store has the ability to act as the glue that converges these two, that sticks these two channels together. It allows the consumer unprecedented levels of control, which they've already embraced with online shopping journeys, and also the convenience and utility of being able to maybe select something online and go in and buy it in store, but also get that benefit, that sensory experience that online can never challenge, which is the try before you buy and potentially expert advice as well. So that's why the store isn't going anywhere, but mobile definitely has the opportunity to augment and enhance the in-store stock shopping experience and tie it more closely back to online, which is often where retailers know more about us. Mm-hmm. In store, we are anonymous customers. The store is a digital black hole, and that needs to change. And of course, as I said in answer to your previous question, if you think about mobile being the infrastructure glue that can tie the identity of a customer online back to their behavior in store, the affiliate networking industry can be the glue that bridges that gap from a purely online engagement to one that also results in engagement in store. It doesn't necessarily have to be a sale. It could be, clicking on a notification to view a recipe, or to download a voucher that they may or may not use at that time. I think the affiliate industry's done so much already online. That expertise is really, really well placed to help bring that convergence to life in store via mobile.
Yeah. You mentioned actually some of those kind of pain points that brick and mortar retailers are facing in the current climate, and because of those changing consumer habits and the role, the pivotal role that digital really plays for them in terms of looking up products and finding products that they potentially might want to buy. I wonder, given the current specific circumstances around coronavirus, whether or not that's something that may potentially accelerate the impact of some of those challenges that they were already facing on the high street and in physical kind of spaces because of the natural consequence of people removing themselves from spaces where they might come into more physical proximity and contact and potentially exposure to the virus itself.
Yes, absolutely. You know, very, it's absolutely top of retailers' minds at the moment. It's only exacerbating what was already a very, very difficult position. I think I saw latest footfall figures for January were down 7.8%, which is just... gosh, awful. I mean, had we had this conversation a couple of months ago before we even knew what COVID-19 was, I would have said that those kinds of challenges that result in dwindling footfall and sales, making retailers overstored and underperforming, really come down to that lack of the online channel exposing what we gain from the online channel and why we've embraced it as consumers, really exposing the shortcomings of the store being a digital, you know, your average store being a digital black hole, and that the store shopping experience really has to become better in order to attract customers, give customers a reason back to come back to stores, to start frequenting stores. I mean, it's not all doom and gloom on that front. It has to be said that you mentioned shopping malls, not just your average high street store. Mm. They are on average seeing a much more positive performance from their food and beverage tenants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when it comes to placemaking at the moment, retail property estate, I know estate trends, I know those anchor shops that they used to rely on are increasingly being replaced by cinemas and chain restaurants and things as bizarre as axe throwing clubs.
Yeah.
You know, just things that are going to give consumers another reason to come into public places, public retail spaces, other than purely to shop. And and also we're seeing the trend, that trend reflected by retailers in adding more hospitality capabilities into their own formats. So that might be more fresh for grocers, or it might be cafes for people like John Lewis. Anyone from John Lewis to Tiffany have opened cafes. So that's how they were dealing with those specific store challenges. And again, I would underline, you know, bringing more digital into those spaces has only got to improve that situation by joining up the online experience and allowing me to navigate my own space or find offers and relevant information on product provenance or outfit ideas there as I'm at the shelf edge about to make the decision. When it comes to COVID-19, as I said, all of these problems become exacerbated because people are staying away from areas of high exposure, potential high exposure. I think we're seeing, from what I'm seeing in the news and what I'm hearing anecdotally, those retailers that have online presences are going to fare best, or that are online only are going to fare best because people are turning to online. It's certainly straining even the likes of Amazon's logistics capabilities. I heard that in the US at the moment, Prime customers are getting notifications that their deliveries might be a day late because of the increased strain on e-commerce supply chain of fulfillment capabilities. But I think clever retailers can use their digital capability to communicate the measures that they're taking in store to protect their staff and their customers, to allay fears. That's one basic sort of hygiene rule that traditional store retailers can apply to their digital presence, but also be really clever from a performance marketing perspective about how they flex their spend and where they apply it, mm-hmm. both online and in store. Maybe trying to incentivize footfall for products that they know are in high demand and that they know might be, not necessarily have a short shelf life in terms of their being like fresh food, but have a short shelf life simply because of the spike in demand for things like hand sanitizer, yeah. toilet roll. I mean, our research has shown that consumers that engage with retailers online and in store really want to be treated better than a one-time anonymous cash-paying customer when they're in store, because you recognize them and you give them recommendations and you push them offers when they're online. Why can't they have the same thing in store? I'm envisaging a situation where, you can ask a customer, a registered online customer, to register for notifications when hand sanitizer comes back into stock in their store or in the store that's nearest their work, so they can pick something up on their way home. I mean, from that from that exchange, the customer's willing to give you not only their home address, which you might already have by proxy of, doing business with them online and delivering to them, but also their work address. You start to infer so much more about that customer from engaging with them digitally to gain, sort of glean more about their purchasing habits and their preferences. I think the basic has to be, everybody, I hope everybody stays safe and that this can be contained. But at the same time, invention is the mother of all necessity, isn't it? And in that sense, I think store-based retailers really have an opportunity to try and do, manage this situation in such a way and differently in such a way as it mitigates the impact on their stores by engaging with customers online and offering them that convenience, that utility, maybe even that preferential treatment that they look for when they're online with you in their store, just to try and get over this period of containment.
Yeah, well, touch wood, it's only a short-term lifespan, obviously, that we're looking at in terms of the outbreak itself. And on the other side of it, hopefully we can start to see more of these kinds of convergence between physical and digital retail and the prospects for both retailers that are, on the high street, but also have that digital presence, have a positive outlook, I think. So I want to thank you for taking the time to speak to us about your article and about some of those wider trends that are occurring within retail. And we look forward to seeing much more of what Eagle Eye are up to over the coming months.
Absolutely. Look forward to working with Awin over the coming months. And thanks for having me on the podcast, Rob. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Perfect. Thanks, Maya. Bye.
Bye.
So now we have Chris Johnson joining us from SmarterClick, who has just recently stepped into the role of Director of Operations. How are you today, Chris?
Hello, Eva. I'm all good, thanks.
Good. So firstly, congratulations on your new role as the Director of Operations at SmarterClick. It'd be great if you could tell us more about your experience within the affiliate industry and also how you got to where you are now.
Yeah, sure. Where do I start? It was quite a long time ago now, I must say. It was about 15, 16 years. It's been quite a long time. Random story, yeah. I had two job offers after I finished my A-levels.
Oh, wow.
One building plane wings at Airbus as an apprentice, and the other one was a internet marketing analyst for a small three-person affiliate company. And I ended up going with the small affiliate business, which I'm sure everyone knows, the Performance Inn now. It was, I think we had the AFU forum at the time, and we did our own affiliate stuff as well. So this is talking a little bit back in the day. And then obviously it turned into an events and publishing business, which I spent some 5 years in that side of my kind of tenure with Matt and the team before moving to another Bristol-based affiliate company. There are a few, believe it or not, in Vector Cloud, which later became Groupon. In January this year, I've been at SmarterClick now for about 8 or 9 weeks and joined the team. I'm still in Bristol, but I am in London still quite frequently as well.
I'm not sure everyone's career path, one or the other, from aviation to affiliates. But yeah, it sounds like you've had a great career history. So I guess for our listeners, you've mentioned that you've just moved over to SmarterClick. Can you tell us more around what they do as a business and where it fits in with the affiliate marketing landscape?
Yeah, of course. SmarterClick's been around for about 4 or 5 years. I should probably check that before I jump on the call. We're essentially a customer conversion specialist. So, we kind of have the tagline of making your website work smarter, not harder. And we've kind of got a number of different kind of products and solutions that we've released over the years, but essentially, we do run everything from, we specialize in exit intent. So, people that are showing signs of leaving, your website, whether that's at the backstage or at certain pages of your website. We've got tech which has been built over many years to detect that and to offer other ways of helping to convert that user. I mean, that's kind of the kind of singular product that they've had in the past, but now we have branched out and we've got a number of different solutions such as Basket, Backup, and which is kind of your email retargeting and remarketing elements to the Smarter Code product, which is our latest product and something that it's kind of quite relevant for my background as well. And that's kind of where we're at the moment.
No, definitely. That's really exciting. I guess it's really exciting times for SmarterClick as well. I know you guys won a few awards as well at the PMAs last year. And you've just touched briefly on your SmarterClick new product. Are you able to explain more about this new product? I guess how it's different to your current products that you have and sort of what new innovations it brings?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a really interesting product, especially from my background in the affiliate space, for sure. But essentially, it's a way for brands to get complete oversight and essentially control over the whole voucher ecosystem, the whole dealings of them and the voucher code that they offer out. It's not just necessarily in the affiliate space, but also kind of email, CRM, any time a code is really used at the basket level of their websites. But I think the most important stats that I have with it, really, that we've looked at from our dealings with a few brands, one of which I'm pleased to say we've been shortlisted for the awards, which is good news, is that working codes really do help the conversion journey. I mean, I'm sure we all know that just from the basis of being such a big part of the sector for many brands. But a working code that we've seen from a number of our data will convert at around about 55%.
Oh, wow.
Whereas invalid codes can actually convert only around 11 to 14%, which is kind of what we're seeing on average. So there's a huge gap in terms of when a code actually is valid, is working, and it improves the purchase journey, as opposed to when it is invalid. It could be fake, it could have expired, it might not be, it might be misspellings, all that sort of thing. And then you're only seeing an 11 to 14% conversion rate. So from a revenue perspective for brands, it's quite an eye-opener, because actually if you were to improve that purchase journey and make sure that codes are valid and are in time and all that sort of stuff, then you would see a significant increase in the overall revenue because of that conversion rate. So it's an interesting tool. It's a way, I guess, you can see which publishers' channels are referring your traffic and how valuable it is to your revenue. It's really good for things like benchmarking, promotion performance, and also kind of sourcing incremental revenue. And there's an interesting case study that we've had, which we can talk about with, I think one of Avon's clients, actually Pretty Little Thing, in that they were actually able to use the code product to improve not only kind of the top 5 publisher growth, but there's a particular publisher in there who they were able to use the tool to improve the purchase journey through them, to improve the code that they had, to make sure that they were promoting correct offers and highlighting when they weren't, which actually resulted in a significant increase in ROI and conversion rate. But also, it enabled them to look through the kind of whole publisher sphere for them and those affiliates that do use codes, and could actually then say, well, actually, they generated 10 sales, and they've used 10 valid voucher codes, with 100% validity rate. Let's work with them more closely. Let's give them some better content, and let's see whether we can improve the revenue coming from them. And actually, in that particular instance as well, we saw a 60% ROI increase and a 30% conversion rate. So, again, it's talking about the key metrics and all that sort of stuff. It's a really good tool for brands to start to use to help improve their overall performance. And actually, I'll stop selling our promises. The overall impact on their program performance was picked up as well. So there was a significant increase on that side. So overall, I think the kind of trail of thumb is, if you can get really dig into your code strategies, it can actually have a finer impact on the overall program performance as well. So again, key metrics that we all get targeted on, and that we can see generally does help retailers in the space.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think, you know, the results from that case study are great, and it's really interesting to see that you're able to look at, I guess, the publishers that are driving, like you said, 10 valid sales out of the 10 valid codes they put forward, and actually who are driving those sort of, I guess, incremental sales on the program. And I think it's a great product for brands to be using, especially with maybe the hesitancy around, you know, voucher codes and what's incentive, what's incrementality of them for the product. So I guess from your side, it's sort of a no-brainer really for brands sort of including this into their strategy and really thinking more about looking at that sort of what is working and what isn't working, and using products like what SmarterClick have and products that are out there in the industry to sort of help work alongside with publishers.
Yeah, it's really important, I think. Again, every year we get questioned more and more, you know, we've had it for many years around the incrementality of space and how the big drivers do have their place and do drive added value. And I can see that from previous companies that there is significant value to be had, and especially when it's worked correctly and when you have a good strategy in place and when you can then optimize what you're doing as well, you can start to really benchmark the performance and the incremental revenue that those people can drive. And like I say, the product can find the kind of jewels in the rough as well, where essentially you've got longer tail publishers that may not have been on radar, could certainly become on radar all of a sudden. And equally, little tweaks here and there on the bigger programs can help drive a significant amount more revenue.
Thank you very much, Chris, for all your insights into, you know, the latest products with SmarterClick and all around the smarter codes. And then thank you for joining our podcast. And I wish you all the best in your new role and your time at SmarterClick.
No worries. Thanks for the time. Cheers.
Big thanks to Maya and Chris for joining us for this month's episode and lending us their respective insights and views on the state of the channel. And also a big thank you to Louisa for joining us in this particular episode.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's been great. Really enjoyed my first episode of the AWIN podcast. And watch out, Craig, because I'll be taking your seat.
Yeah, Craig, there are only 3 microphones available. So you're going to have to fight this one out with Louisa now, and my money's on Louisa. Before we go, I know, Kev, you wanted to highlight an article that was has achieved some prominence in the industry recently, which came out of DigiDay, I think, one of the industry publications, and featured BuzzFeed talking about how important and central affiliate as a source of revenue has become for their business.
Yeah, so it was a really interesting article, actually, that we've just literally come across today. So you can find it by, it's actually a podcast that DigiDay have done with BuzzFeed CEO Jonah Peretti. And he's talking about how they've transformed BuzzFeed into a kind of money-making and hopefully profitable business this year. And they make specific reference to affiliate marketing, and it's a really, really nice kind of success story for the channel. So I definitely recommend sort of checking out that article. Just to give you sort of a quick quote, he says, it's a great business. It's very high margin revenue that comes back to us. The reason we were able to do that is that we had this big network. We had lots of people who love BuzzFeed content. Because we had focused on making shareable content, we thought a lot about how people take action. How does content inspire someone to do something? In early BuzzFeed, it was about inspiring someone to share something with a friend. Now we took that same data-driven approach to say, can we make something that inspires someone to buy something or transact or go on a trip? So it's just a really nice kind of, I suppose, summary of the power of the channel. And it's definitely something that is probably a little bit more slow moving than we want, but it's definitely that kind of gradual shift towards greater awareness of the affiliate channel.
Yeah, and it's not the only kind of publisher of that ilk that we've seen take affiliate and make it into something that is a larger proportion of their in-house revenue that they're driving income from. Like, we went to the Association of Online Publishers event late last year, which actually initiated the Mass Media Strategy Day that we talked about in the introduction. And there was a case study there given by Shortlist, one of the media house publishers that we work with, who talked about the fact that affiliate had been a central pillar of their revenue and had actually displaced a lot of the more traditional income sources such as programmatic display, and had been wildly or hugely effective in that respect, which was a really nice anecdote to hear.
Yeah, I think there's a real emerging narrative around that about how programmatic at the moment, there's a lot of question marks about the future of programmatic and how data is going to be used in a sort of a retargeted way. And for affiliate, where it's a lot more of a data-like channel, it provides a sort of really, I think, quite attractive sort of counterpoint to that. And so it's one that we are kind of firmly aware of and know that we need to be kind of pushing harder and harder to get interest in.
Yeah, well, not to bring everything back to the Aon report, I feel like everything I say these days kind of leads back to me referencing the Aon report, but there is a great article in there featuring Paul Cunliffe from Shortlist, as well as another publisher, Mary Claire, and talking about how media houses are starting to take the affiliate channel that much more seriously as an income source. So that's well worth checking out if that's something that you're interested in finding out more about. However, that's all we've got time for in this month's episode. So thank you, both of you guys, for joining me. But we'll be back in a few weeks with another edition of Aon Talks. In the meantime, stay healthy and
wash your hands.
And we'll hopefully see you in April.